You are listening to Unbreakable. This podcast shines the light on family and domestic violence. We discuss the various forms of family and domestic violence, what it looks like, and we talk to the experts and survivors. Unbreakable is sponsored by DV Assist, a free counselling and web chat service for people living in regional, rural, and remote Western Australia. They support anyone experiencing family and domestic violence. Some of the content in this episode may be confronting or distressing. We would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians upon the land on which we record this podcast today and extend our respects to those listening on regional, rural and remote Western Australia. Family and domestic violence affects people from all walks of life. We understand men and LGBTIQA+ experience family and domestic violence. However, statistics show women are more overrepresented. For this purpose, in the podcast, we will refer to she when discussing people experiencing violence and he when discussing people who use violence. Hi, we are Lisa and Lindsay, and today we'll be talking about coercive control. This is an issue which has been gaining more traction in the media and with politicians lately. In the last two episodes, Sam shared her story of violence, where she also experienced coercive control among the other forms of abuse. Sam was in a relationship for 2 years with Brad, and the coercive control didn't start until they moved in together. In today's episode, we're going to cover what exactly is coercive control and focus on the murder of Hannah Clark. Coercive control, we hear this term a lot, especially recently. So what exactly is coercive control, Lisa?
So it's really interesting, Lindsay, because this term coercive control was only coined in 2007 by Evan Stark, so it's only pretty new. The way he describes it, and I'll read from here as his description, is a pattern of behaviour which seeks to take away the victim's liberty or freedom, to strip away their sense of self. It is not just a woman's bodily integrity which is violated, but also their human rights.
I have to say, coercive control is just not an easy term to define. It's not something that, you know, we can quickly just go, it's this. It actually has multiple layers and characteristics, but there is things that connect it together. I like to talk about it as kind of like a spider's web, and that's where this name of the podcast, Entrapment, came from, coercive control, because it's, as Jess Hill describes, it kind of walks someone into a web of entrapment. And it's very difficult to leave, just like when a spider has their prey in the web. It's like it's gooey and sticky in there.
That's a really good analogy, actually.
It is, right? Yeah. Like, I was just like, that really sums it up for me. And it's just, it's very difficult. It's confusing. It's challenging. And so Jess Hill actually breaks down coercive control into four factors in her book, See What You Made Me Do. If you haven't read it and you're really interested in this content, totally recommend it. So I'm actually going to summarise some of the sections because I really do think she describes it really well. But basically she describes coercive control as a strategic campaign of abuse held together by fear. And that these four factors of violence, intimidation, isolation, and control comprise it. Jess Hill refers specifically to the Perpetrator's Handbook, and her book describes in detail the blueprint for establishing power from Biedermann's Chart of Coercion, which we'll start to go into in a moment, but it really tends to follow a pattern.
And it's funny that you mentioned that because it's something that I hear all the time from a lot of clients, and it's who are experiencing coercive control, is that the method follows a pattern. And it's really important to understand that what causes the fear for individuals as specific and targeted. So it's not something that, like the Perpetrator Handbook, it doesn't exist. It's tailor-made to a victim, which is really quite scary. And it's to have rules in place and punishments in place or a look or a word which only means something to the victim or the person experiencing it. Whereas anyone else just go, nah, that's nothing. It's nothing to worry about. But that other person knows what it is. So it's to control their partner, and it controls their hopes, their fears, their dreams, their aspirations, and what they build this into the tactics to control them, which is, it's quite scary when you think about it.
It is, and I think you make such a good point there that the person using violence and perpetrating coercive control, it's they find out what are the fears and the hopes and the challenges that, let's say, their partner has, and they use those against them through the control. And that's what we say. It can look different in terms of that, the nuance, but the spider's web, it has the key characteristics of control, intimidation, yeah, isolation, and fear. All right, so let's get into Jess Hill's description in her book that follows the pattern. How does it all start? And it actually, coercive control starts with just establishing love and trust. You know, it's kind of any start of a relationship, there's a connection. It's in this stage, it's the first stage of domestic abuse. It's the development of love, trust, and intimacy. It is love that binds the victim to her abuser and love that makes her forgive and make excuses for him. And I think that's a really good point because it's those when there's the cycle of violence and it's like, you know, the apologies and the good moments. It's not all bad. There are times that there's good times, and it's usually for some, for many, is that it's those memories that keep us there, and it's very difficult to get out of that web.
Yeah, and it's funny you mention love because love is such a controversial term, and we don't always want to acknowledge it when we're looking at family and domestic violence, in particular coercive control, because the word love, it's controversial. It's not normal to experience these experience, you know, these forms of control in a loving, respectful relationship. And love needs to be present for this to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's uncomfortable to acknowledge. It's something we don't always want to acknowledge, but love is the first step of this happening, because the control and the jealousy and the abuse doesn't come first, and then you fall in love with an abuser. You fall in love with the person, and then it happens later on.
So. Exactly, and that's where we've talked about it before, but love bombing, that's where the showering of gifts and affection and attention and displaying, you know, empathy, it all those things that make, you know, some characteristic of a good relationship, it's that early development stage. And the trust, as we were saying before, it's, you know, getting to know the fears and the hopes. That's letting down your guard and someone, you know, getting to know you, that enables trust. So then it goes into isolation. And Jess Hill says here, as long as the victim maintains meaningful social and emotional connections, the abuser's influence is diluted. And really good point, because in order to become the most powerful person in her life, in order to control, he must eliminate her external sources of support and silent voices that would question his behaviour. So if he can remove the partner into another city, country, region, remove and isolate from friends and family, therefore they're not getting their outside perspective, or they're not able to observe what might be going on in the relationship. Then we've got monopolised perception, which is where, as through the isolation, the person using violence monopolizes how they think, how they, you know, what they do. So it's not, don't believe your friends and family. You just got to listen to me. I'm here for you. So it kind of takes the attention away from the partner's faults, actually, and starts to actually focus on her faults. So what she's doing, how she caused that. If she didn't do this, it wouldn't happen. And so, you know, whilst he's isolating her, she's depending on him and his viewpoint and slowly adopts his way of thinking. And this is where we can start to see some of the self-esteem getting eroded and the put-downs and it's all my fault. The blame is her and not him.
And at this point is where the partner becomes the be-all and end-all. It's the main person in their life. They don't have anyone else. They are everything to them. They're their friend, partner, lover, best mate. They're everything, you know, so which kind of allows them to be able to monopolize every part of their life because there's no one else there.
Exactly. And that's starting to doubt your own perception and your reality. And this is gaslighting. So that's the next step that Jess Hill goes into is induced debility and exhaustion. So gaslighting is when the abuser knowingly denies, fabricates and manipulates situations to make his partner doubt her own memory and perception as she becomes more confused and anxious. She actually starts to believe his interpretation of events may be more reliable than her own. And this was key in Sam's story, where Brad actually, there was a moment in her story where, she was covering the bruises on her face with makeup, and he said, "Oh, there's no bruises there." And that's a key moment in that gaslighting, to start to, you know, get inside her mind and then really doubt her own perception.
And then we go into other things as well. So there's enforcing trivial demands. It could be other things that you don't normally think about, like forbidding sex or clothing. You can't wear that skirt. You can't. Oh. But it's not always overt as, like, you can't wear that. It could be, "Oh, I wish you'd leave that dress for me. Like, I like the way you wear that for me." It could be, you know, going in a bar and someone says, "Excuse me," you know, as they're brushing past. It's like, are you talking to other men? Who did you talk to today? Mm-hmm. Was Fred at work there? What happened? What did you do? And then it could be other stuff like, "We're having spaghetti bolognese tonight. I don't care that you want fish. We're having this." And it could be, you know, and then it could be the, in a subtle way, like, "Oh, how would you fancy this tonight for dinner? You know, I really feel like that." So you don't kind of question it. And then there could be other ones like, "Well, you can only shower once a day. We're saving water. We're saving money. You can only shower once a day." So they control those trivial things that you do every day. Mm-hmm. Then there's other parts, like where they demonstrate complete control of your life. You know, the surveillance. What time are you going to be home? What time do you finish? Okay, it takes half an hour on the freeway. You should be home at 6:45. You know, it could be what time are you there? I'm checking to see you at this point on the freeway. I'm checking to see where you are. It could be other stuff about going to the shops. What did you buy kale for? We don't need any kale. We're not going to use that kale. You know, stupid stuff like that. That, again, you're not really going to think about is controlling. It could be the big stuff like when they have sex and what sexual activity they engage in. We'll use one example. It could be bondage or sex toys, or even anal sex, where they don't feel comfortable in doing it, but you're coerced into doing it. You know, "I'll do this for you tomorrow if you perform fellatio on me. If you do this, I'll look after the kids tomorrow if we can have sex tomorrow morning before you go to work.
If you loved me, you would do that for me."
Yeah.
"Or we're married, you know, or why don't you just do it? Like, something new."
"Yeah, I really want it. I know you're tired, but I really need an outlet," you know. So it could be things like that, which is quite big. Then there's other things like hiding your car keys or your smart rider so you can't go to work, hiding your phone or your laptop so you can't communicate with friends, family, work to say you're not coming in, changing your password on internet banking, or changing the apps on your phone. I've heard that a few times about passwords gone to log on online banking and doesn't work anymore. Then there's also the big ones like installing spyware on your phone, on your having tracking devices on your car, cameras in your house to see what they're doing. That's what goes into like stalking and harassment and surveillance. And that often happens in coercive control, not only when they're still with a partner, but after they've left. And then there'll be other like alternative punishments where there's meant to be a reward. And that goes back into what we were saying before, you know, if you loved me, you would do this. It'd be like, "Oh, if you do this for me, I'll buy you that ring you like. If you do that for me, I will do this for you." So it's kind of, you're getting a reward out of it, but it's almost like that positive reinforcement, but it's actually negative reinforcement. So that's actually quite scary.
That is, and also the guilt, like the guilt on the person to do it. You know, "If you loved me or we're in a married partnership, you know, you should be doing this." That guilt is a really big factor in coercive control for some people.
Yeah, and using that guilt, because no one likes to feel guilty.
No.
We all like to think we're good partners and, you know, we're treating our partners right. So if you're feeling guilty, it's like, "Oh, am I doing something wrong? I must have done something wrong."
And that's that questioning, and we go back to that gaslighting, and then, yeah, the isolation, it all kind of feeds into it. He must be right. His version of events is right.
Yeah. And then we look at the other things that are more, that are not as subtle, threats towards friends, family, pets, which is the one that gets me the most, always fails to upset me when I hear the dog or the cat have been hurt or threatened. damaging or breaking property, smashing phones, smashing their car, knowing that an ornament from great art Gertrude from the 1900s is their favourite thing, so they threaten to smash it. And that can often be in front of people too. You're naughty, so naughty like you're a child, like, I'm going to smash these. Then there's the degradation, like the bullying, the put-downs, the nasty jokes, trying to be funny, disguise it as a joke when it's not funny, constantly criticising, you know, you don't do your hair right, you don't make my coffee right, you don't clean the house right. If anyone's actually watched Coronation Street and Into the British Soapies, that's actually a classic example of it, actually, where he used to put crosses all around the skirting boards to see if she cleaned. So Coronation Street actually had a really good storyline on coercive control and really showed what those behaviours look like. It started off quite covert to end up being really overt.
That sense of just, I can't do anything right, like nothing is good enough. And there's always something.
Yeah, always something. It's like you, and I think what a lot of people say to me is, I feel like I can never win.
Yeah.
I'm never going to win. And it's always like you were set up to fail, that like you were never going to win, which is, it's quite disturbing, really.
Okay. So now we're actually going to get into the Hannah Clark case.
Sure. So with Hannah Clark, with these, for so long we were looking at these behaviours and didn't actually realise they had a name, which is funny. So, well, not funny, but we were looking at these behaviours for so long, and I was working in a refuge for a long time, and we would see these form of behaviours and we put it down to emotional and psychological abuse. Until, unfortunately, the sad death of Hannah and her children, this term coercive control came out, and it really gave us, I think for the first time, I really understood that these behaviours were called a thing. So the horrific murder of Hannah Clark and her three children sadly brought to light what coercive control was.
Oh, this case was definitely one of the extremes and one of the worst cases ever reported.
Agreed. And I do remember when it was reported that it was all on the news. And like I said, I was working at a refuge and I was at the refuge at the time. I just remember all of us just being really shocked. And it wasn't till they released some of the details of the case in the media that, again, like what we've been seeing for so long had this name. And the different elements that we were seeing were falling under coercive control, and a lot of them is what Hannah had actually experienced herself, according to the media. So
Hannah experienced many of these things, such as being told she can't wear pink or wear shorts, having to have sex every night. He went through her phone, checking where she was, and not allowed to wear a bikini on the beach. Hannah's story was shared by her parents on the Jess Hill series, See What You Made Me Do. It was very difficult to watch.
It was heavy going. Even though I do this job every day, just watching that and watching Hannah Clark's parents, it really brought to light of the impact it can have on someone and someone's family. And it was really quite devastating. I think it's one of the cases that I still listen to now that really kind of stuck with me. And after seeing and hearing so much, it's one that really sort of stays with me. And the worst part is the coercive control is invisible. So from what was reported in the media and Hannah Clark's subsequent inquest, there wasn't a lot of physical signs there. So, you know, police and advocates have been fighting for so long about this, and they know what they're looking for, but the signs are subtle. So it's not easy to walk into someone who's experienced this and go, yep, I can see that right away.
That is such a good point, because we were just saying before, it is subtle with these comments, these, you know, justifications, all of that, and it can look different for different people, but it is subtle. It's, you know, it can be overt in different cases and as time progresses, but that subtlety makes it really hard to pinpoint. It's not, you know, like you said, there was no physical abuse or physical signs in the earlier days of Hannah Clark and Rowan Baxter. So it can be very challenging to piece it all together.
Yeah, for sure. And if we go into the case of Hannah Clark, so for anybody that isn't fully aware of the situation or the case, so in February 2020 in a Brisbane suburb, Hannah was getting her three kids into the car to go on a school run. Usual morning every day, I'd said goodbye to her mum. Mum went off to work. So Hannah and the kids went in the car. Only her estranged husband ambushed her jumped into the car, told her to drive, and doused her, the car, and the kids in petrol and threatened to set them on fire, which he actually did. He actually did set her on fire, held a knife to Hannah and told her to drive. So it wasn't until Hannah, as she was driving, actually saw a man watering his lawn that she pulled up in the front and started screaming and saying, you know, my babies are in the car. And her children actually perished in the car that day, almost immediately. And Hannah later died in hospital. But in the meantime, Hannah stayed with 97% burns to her body, managed to stay alive long enough to give tell her story twice to first responders, which blows my mind, to be able to do that, to have that strength to stay alive that long. And she must have been in immense pain to stay alive long enough to tell her story, not once but twice. So police and paramedics knew what had happened. And her ex-husband or estranged husband died at the scene by self-inflicted wounds, stab wounds to himself. And that really is kind of telling for a lot of people that use coercive control. The control is gone. He didn't have control of her anymore, and he wasn't going to live with her, but he wasn't going to live without her, and he didn't want to deal with the consequences of what he'd done, is our assumption, of course. So when this case actually came out, it really drew attention to the controlling behaviours that we'd been seeing for so long, which is coercive control. And it wasn't until we sort of heard that term and realised that Evan Stark had actually coined this term in 2007 and written a whole book on what coercive control was and what it looked like. So when this case was reported, it came out that Hannah had actually suffered at the hands of this man who was supposed to love her. He controlled what she did, what she wore, who she spoke to. He called her every day at work to make sure that she was there. He ridiculed and made fun of her body after she'd given birth to three children. He demanded sex every night and sulked for days if she didn't enjoy it as much as he wanted. He was cruel to Hannah and her children, you know, doing things that is meant to be funny but actually hurting them. He'd strangled her before during sex, and it was something that when it was reported to authorities, it wasn't really considered anything. It wasn't considered important because it happened in a sexual setting, which, as we know now, strangulation combined with coercive control is a precursor to homicide. He was known to lack empathy, and Hannah and the kids were reported to be feeling like they were walking on eggshells. When she finally left him, he stalked and harassed her. He bugged her house, kidnapped their little girl or their middle child, took her to another state for a few days and didn't bring her back until the police intervened. He even tried to get Hannah fired from her job. And Hannah told friends that she was fearful for her life and thought that he would kill her. But she never thought he would kill the kids. And she actually asked a friend about advice about writing a will. And she felt trapped in the marriage. She felt trapped in this situation. And it wasn't until the inquest came out. The inquest happened in March, April this year in 2022. It came out about how cruel that Rowan Baxter was to others and his family, and how he started to spiral when he realized he was losing control of Hannah. So he truly and honestly believed he owned Hannah and his three kids. There was footage released at the inquest 2 days before the murder of him in a hardware store like Bunnings or something, where he was buying a jerry can for the petrol. And then 15 hours before the murder, he actually called the men's helpline. And the recordings played at the inquest, but even then he's not taking any responsibility for what he's done. He's placed all the blame on Hannah and totally played the victim of he's the hard done by husband and look what my partner's done. And not once is in this recording that you can hear, it is public, on public record, that he ever takes ownership of what he's done. And when people are in coercive control and the coercive controllers are starting to feel like they're losing control, the consequences can be fatal for their victims.
Yes, and I can only imagine Hannah, you know, you mentioned there that she felt trapped in the relationship but also outside the relationship, and, you know, she mentioned that, oh, there could be dire consequences here, but she never thought the children. And, you know, I want to share with you actually some research by Dr. Carolyn Johnson. So we actually had Dr. Carolyn Johnson come in and do some training with us and staff at DV Assist on intimate partner homicide and familial homicide. And we can really hypothesize with Rowan Baxter here. So in her research through interviews with survivors and perpetrators and their families, highlighted actually a theory of why people might kill their family, so their partner, their family, and sometimes themselves. And one of the key findings from this research was that, and the training that we received, was that, you know, the most at risk a person is at is not just when they leave their partner, as for some it can be up to 7 times before they finally leave, and there's a number of factors and reasons for that, but it's actually because there's usually attempts at reconciliation and still hope of repair. So the person using violence might think, I can get her back, there's time to get her back, I haven't lost full control yet. But it was also through the training that risk is also high as well when the person realizes their partner is not returning this time, that there is no hope of reconciliation, that it's truly over and I've lost full control. So in Hannah's case, we can actually hypothesize, we don't know for sure because we can't interview Rowan Baxter, but from the research, that he knew he had lost control because Hannah was moving on and not coming back this time. She was serious. And it was also at that point where the violence and intent to kill escalated. I've lost control. I need to regain control. And this is what comes from Dr. Carolyn Johnson's research again. It was in familial homicide where the perpetrator kills the partner, the children, and themselves. The psychology of the perpetrator is essentially, in a nutshell, if I cannot have her, no one else can. But also that killing the children inflicts such pain and emphasizes the level of control that I can even control how and who I kill. So the research also highlights the concept of symbiosis. So it's that sense of we're together again, even in death. So this research is quite in depth, but just to highlight some of it, kind of shines a light, doesn't it, on why people might do what they do and how coercive control can be very life-threatening.
Yeah, for sure. And Dr. Carolyn's research was actually really interesting when she was presenting it here at DV Assist. And it's in no means any excuse for anybody that decides to kill their partner and their kids. And her research, interestingly, did not have any women that killed their partner and the kids. It was all men. And I found that really interesting as well. That wasn't something that I was expecting that the research in the time period that she'd done it, which was over, you know, a substantial amount of years, that it was men that killed their partner and killed their children and had the attachment issues. Yet women had a different form of attachment and was less likely to go that. And she didn't actually have a case where women went and did that, which was a surprise to me. I wasn't expecting that. But in no means it is an excuse. But it does go into the psyche of the person who is the coercive controller of why they may do what they do.
And also gives that education to those that might be listening or might know someone who might be experiencing coercive control. Yes, it is when they leave, but it's also when there's that point of she's not coming back. And that could be months or even a year or so down the track. When there's those attempts to reunify and like reconcile just haven't gone forward, and that can be quite dangerous. So I thought that was a really important point.
Yeah, that is really interesting. And then when we go back to Hannah Clark's case, you know, we can't deny it was a tragedy. It was heinous. And as I said, I think it's probably in my 15 years or so of working, 16 years of working in community services and 13 in DV, I think it's probably one of the worst cases, if not the worst case I've ever heard, that was upsetting. And out of the sadness of this and the tragedy of her case, of her and her three children, the awareness of coercive control unwittingly has come at the forefront of the media and a lot of, you know, the frontline workers.
Mm.
So frontline workers, survivors, and other stakeholders are really pushing this now to be incorporated into family and domestic violence legislation. The recent inquest into Hannah's death actually had several recommendations, including more funding for, I'll just read them out here, more funding for men's behaviour change programs in the community and in prisons, specialised training for police dealing in family and domestic violence, family and domestic violence specific police stations where victims can have access to all supports and in one place, and addressing information sharing amongst family domestic violence services and police.
Mm.
So in regards to police, there were also recommendations there as well, which included specialised training on coercive control to improve knowledge surrounding this form of abuse. Basically, 40% of police call-outs are FDV related. So this is really quite important recommendation and something to really acknowledge.
Mm.
The inquest also found that at least there were 50% increase of people using violence, threatening their partners with dousing them in flammable liquid and setting them on fire since Hannah's murder.
Mm.
That is extremely disturbing to me.
Yes.
That you could listen to a tragedy such as Hannah Clark and her three children, and instead of being upset or angered or horrified, you go and use that as an excuse to threaten your partner.
Mm.
I'll be honest, that blew me away. That really blew me away. That so with coercive control and by threatening to do what had happened to Hannah, it's like coercive controllers have found another way to instill fear and terror into women, and that really scares me.
That is very scary. That is very scary. Mm. I think the really good point in this as well is just that training to police and around what it looks like and how to navigate it. And I know at the moment in Western Australia, actually, they're looking into community consultation around legislation against coercive control. So should it be a crime in Western Australia? And that consultation is actually going until July 30th. And so the community will be asked to consider, you know, should it be a criminal offence or whether it can be dealt better with by other means. And so if you're interested in contributing to that, there is I'll put it on the episode notes on our website, but there's more information through the Family Violence and Coercive Control government webpage. Yeah, so I think that really sums up today. And just wanted to thank all of our listeners. I think coercive control, I'm really glad it's getting more in the spotlight in the sense of understanding what it looks like, that we're talking about it more, and that it actually, when we turn the curtain away, we actually see how many people are affected by this in different degrees. And just want to reiterate, Debbie Assist is here to support anyone who might be experiencing coercive control, or they might not know it's coercive control, but something might be a bit off. Please contact us.
The common elements of coercive control include isolation, degradation, financial control, intimidation, emotional abuse, sexual violence, controlling friendships and activities, stalking and harassment, and gaslighting. Experiences tend to be the more covert kind, meaning they're hidden and subtle as opposed to being overt forms of control where everybody can see them. Coercive control recognises victims are often hidden in plain sight, and while we don't always know what's going on and others around us may not even notice or even see the signs, therefore they may unintentionally dismiss the abuse. In many cases, police don't even see it as the person using violence is so convincing, so unless police are trained to notice the subtle signs of abuse, they may miss them. For people living in coercive control, physical violence is not always present, however the threat is. And in 90% of domestic homicides, coercive control is present. In Australia, it is not considered a crime, and Tasmania is the only state to recognise these behaviours of coercive control. Therefore, were added into domestic violence legislation in 2005. In other states, domestic violence advocates are pushing for coercive control to be criminalised and be part of legislation. In Queensland, the push is even greater since the Hannah Clark case, and in Western Australia, discussions are happening now with the state government.
When we discuss the Hannah Clark case, we can categorically honestly say Hannah was a true hero, and we believe she was extremely brave to ensure she told her story to authorities, not once but twice. This shows her strength as a woman and a mother to the very end. Our hearts go out to Hannah Clark's family and her friends. Thanks for listening to Unbreakable, and no matter what, they will not break me.
We acknowledge the duration of our podcasts are short and only provide a snapshot of the complex and sensitive topic being discussed. If this content has been upsetting or distressing, recommended support services include DV Assist on 1800 080 083, 1800 Respect on 1800 737 732, or Lifeline on 13 11 14. Visit our website for a range of information and support at www.dvassist.org.au. If you would like to suggest a topic or share your story, please contact us at community@dvassist.org.au. If you have any feedback about this episode, please email us at community@dvassist.org.au. See you next time.